Welcome to Geographical Imaginations, brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. I'm your host, Kevin S. Fox, coming to you from Salzburg, Austria. Stay tuned tonight as we explore the making of heritage. This episode, our 16th, we look at three sites and have two voices, or three if you count mine. One from New York, now in Warsaw, Poland. One from Italy, now in the Netherlands. And me from Connecticut, now in Salzburg. Our three sites are the following. First, we travel a few feet here from where we are, from our radio station, to Salzburg's historic city center, and look at why it's been named as a UNESCO World Heritage Site. And then we take a little ride out to the Hallstatt-Dachstein-Salzkammergut cultural landscape, another one on the list of World Heritage Sites named by UNESCO, familiar to those who have watched the opening scenes to The Sound of Music. And finally, our third site, we make a trip by train to Vienna and spend hours in the famous Viennese coffee houses. First two are official UNESCO cultural heritage sites. The Viennese coffee house environment is now added to the list, the inventory for the country of Austria. Not the house itself, but the environment, the space of the coffee house. All three are considered important representations of world culture. We spend this episode unpacking these UNESCO designations and explore the move towards recognizing this intangible culture by this, the world's most respected heritage recognition body. So stay tuned and enjoy this next expedition. Barbara Kirschenblatt Gimblett is university professor in the Department of Performance Studies at the Tisch School of the Arts at NYU in New York City. She's widely published in museum studies and joins us today to talk about intangible and tangible culture. She is currently working in Warsaw, Poland as program director for the core exhibition at the Museum of the History of Polish Jews. She joins us from Warsaw. Well, thanks for coming on the show. I'd like to start with this, the question about definition, and definitions are always kind of tricky, but UNESCO has come up with three different categories for heritage. We have the tangible, the natural, and the intangible. Can you kind of walk us through what the differences are there, or is there overlap? How does UNESCO kind of define those three terms?
Well, what's interesting for me about the third term, which is the newest one, is that it's a kind of residual category, or perhaps better said, it's defined by what it is not and not by what it is. In other words, tangible heritage is literally heritage that you can touch, and it refers specifically to cultural heritage, heritage made by people. Natural heritage is referring to landscape and to natural environments, and we know that these are not such clear-cut categories, and that the natural environment has been very much shaped by human presence. But nonetheless, we're looking first and foremost at the natural environment. And the latest category, intangible heritage, which is an odd term because, as I said earlier, it defines, it's a definition that is in the negation of something. So in other words, it's heritage that is not tangible. So the question is, what precisely is it? Yeah. And this is referring, this is a way of recognizing that not all culture is tangible, leaving a material trace. And the intangible heritage, UNESCO's terms, was very often heritage that preserved the original material. And what that did, historically, was to privilege those societies that created monuments, buildings, other material forms in durable material. What does that mean? It means clay, ceramic, stone. But any society that built temporary shelters, fabric, using perishable natural materials, wood, they wouldn't make it to that tangible heritage list because the definition, if you will, the criterion, was that the original material should be preserved, that somehow that was what authenticated that particular building. And I think that over the years, there's been a recognition not only of that that's very limiting in terms of the overrepresentation of certain societies over others, but also it's a kind of misplaced emphasis on materiality. And the best example I can give of a case where the line between tangible and intangible heritage is, number one, not so clear, and where the emphasis on original material is irrelevant, and where intangible heritage is valued over tangible heritage. The best example I can think of is the Jingju Shrine in Japan. And this is a wooden shrine, which is, the advocates for it like to say, it's 800 years old, but never more than 20 years old, because every 20 years they tear it down in order to have to rebuild it. Now, why? Because the only way to transmit the knowledge of how to build it is by building it. And in order to need to build it, you have to tear it down. What that means is that the knowledge of how to build it is valued more than the original material from which the shrine is built. And the knowledge of how to build it is, if you will, it's intangible. So what is it precisely? Well, it's embodied. In a sense, the body is the archive for this knowledge. It is a relationship to tools, to materials, but it's also a relationship to social relations, to craft, to the transmission of these, not only these skills, but also these values. And the only way to transmit them is personally, so to speak. It's through the act, through the performance, through the doing, and it's very social. And none of that fits the definition of material heritage in the sense of a monument. The pyramids, the Eiffel Tower, whatever physical, you know, the Empire State Building, whatever the physical material, architectural presence. It's right. Really, what it is, it's a culturally specific way of placing value that is a value that is not expressed in terms of the materials. And that, I think, that is to say, the durability of the material. And that, I think, is really at the heart of it. That would be my single best example.
And that's the shift, really. It's to, in terms of identifying then the intangible, is really to accept or even just then start to identify and accept the idea that a cultural practice is something that is heritage that gets passed down.
Yes, but I go even further. I would say that that there's something very artificial about separating material culture from, if you will, immaterial culture, or tangible heritage from intangible heritage. To do that, in a sense, is to create matter that doesn't matter.
Right.
Because the what we think of as tangible heritage is its value. In fact, the values that are ascribed to it, whether historically, traditionally, today, in the future, those values are intangible. And without those values, without those understandings, without those social and cultural practices, this is matter that doesn't matter. It's simply inert matter.
You're listening to Geographical Imaginations, brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. To find out more about the show, check us out online at www.geographicalimaginations.org. To give some feedback or suggestion for a future episode, go to the comments section on the website, or go to the blog and enter into the conversation. Salzburg is an outstanding example of an ecclesiastical city-state, peculiar to the Holy Roman Empire from Prussia to Italy. Most disappeared as political and administrative units in the early 19th century and adopted alternative trajectories of development. No other example of this type of political organism has survived so completely, preserving its urban fabric and individual buildings to such a remarkable degree as Salzburg. Salzburg is the point where the Italian and German cultures met, and which played a crucial role in the exchanges between these two cultures. The result is a Baroque town that has emerged intact from history, an exceptional material testimony of a particular culture and period. The center of Salzburg owes much of its Baroque appearance to the Italian architects Vincenzo Scamozzi and Santino Solari. The Salzburg skyline against the backdrop of mountains is characterized by its profusion of spires and domes, dominated by the fortress of Hohenzollern. It contains a number of buildings, both secular and ecclesiastical, of very high quality, from periods ranging from the late Middle Ages to the 20th century. There's a clear separation, visible on the ground and on the map, between the lands of the Prince Archbishops and those of the burghers. The former is characterized by its monumental buildings, the cathedral, the residence, the Franciscan Abbey, the Abbey of St. Peter, and its open spaces, the Domplatz in particular. The burghers' houses, by contrast, are on small plots in front onto narrow streets, with the only open spaces provided by the three historic markets. Salzburg is rich in buildings from the Gothic period onwards, which combine to create a townscape and urban fabric of great individuality and beauty. Salzburg is also intimately associated with many important artists and musicians, preeminent among them Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. So this was the official designation, the official description of the historic city center of Salzburg, as it appears on UNESCO's World Heritage website. Of course, official representations of a place will always give the best, and that narrative will always portray the way the placemakers and the place marketers want us to think about it. There's no question about it. And the historical accuracy, that's not what's at question here for us, I think, in this episode. As we move forward, I think one of our critical questions we need to pose in talking about World Heritage Sites and the official designation that is granted to them by UNESCO is what happens when a place is, or at least one of the questions, is what happens to that place after it has been designated, and Salzburg has been on the lists for, I think, around 20 years now. What happens to that place? 20 years ago, there were no, or there were very few, luxury, high-end shopping stores, basically, in the downtown area. Now you can see major luxury brands occupying the small business spaces on the ground floors of many of the old buildings. And so what's happening in this process? What's happening post-designation by UNESCO? And that's a little bit of what we want to explore tonight. Really start to unpack this commodification process that happens once you are on the UNESCO list.
Anytime UNESCO makes a designation, which is designated enters a canon, and it is the seal of approval. And it really adds value. Literally, it is added value. And particularly in cases, I mean, it's one thing to have something that's valuable and then have it, in a sense, endorsed and protected. It's another thing to add value to something that wasn't valued. It's, in a sense, a discovery of its value, and the validation comes with that seal of approval and the entry of whatever is designated into this world canon, which is the UNESCO canon.
I originally found Barbara Kirschenblatt Gimblett's work, who herself is a renowned anthropologist. I found it in a special issue of Museum International that looked at intangible heritage. And the name of her article, if you're looking for it, was Intangible Heritage as Metacultural Production. And so I wanted to push her and find out a little bit more about what she meant in this article.
I think that there is the illusion when we speak of heritage that we are dealing with something that already exists as heritage. And what I would argue is that nothing is born as heritage, that whatever there is in the world becomes heritage when it is declared as such. Now, what does it mean to declare something as heritage? It means it's to take a practice or an object or an environment and to endow it with value. And the value with which it is endowed is heritage value. Now, what does that entail? It entails a designation, adding it to a list, maybe a guidebook. It might involve celebrations, anniversaries, a whole set of practices that actually make that place or make that practice into something new. In other words, the conversion of cultural practices, aspects of daily life, environments, objects. The conversion of what is otherwise just something into heritage is what I call a mode of cultural production. It involves cultural practices that transform something from just being something into being heritage, which means something where value has been added, and the value that has been added is heritage value.
And it's become codified, essentially,
It's become something else. It's actually become something new. Here we're taking steps that are intended to preserve something old, but in the process we have created something new, and what we've created that is new is heritage, which is a designation, if you will, that refers to the past, but in the process actually creates something new.
And it's right. It's our thinking about what is the past in the present, right? I mean, it's
exactly.
Yeah, it's our assumptions about the past. It's sometimes could even brought in the idea or the sense of authenticity and what we think is the authentic from the past, and trying to celebrate that. And yet, like you say, we're then creating something new, perhaps a hybrid, but new nonetheless. You are listening to Geographical Imaginations, brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. Geographical Imaginations is an hour-long radio essay program broadcast monthly from Radio Fabrique in Salzburg, Austria. This public geography project presents a geographical or spatial way of thinking about our relationships with the worlds we inhabit and co-create. Each episode takes a theme, or perhaps a question, and explores it through an interactive dialogue with different texts and voices. For more information about the show, check out the website at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Now let's get back to our episode. Marilena Vecco is assistant professor of cultural economics at Erasmus University Rotterdam. In the Department for the Study of the Arts and Culture, she lectures in the MA Cultural Economics and Cultural Entrepreneurship program. Her research focuses on cultural entrepreneurship, management with a special focus on cultural heritage, both tangible and intangible, and art markets. She joins us today from Rotterdam.
This UNESCO list is really is under debate because UNESCO list has been created in order to highlight the specificity, the value of a specific cultural natural site. When it has been introduced, it was really a nice instrument because it could provide more information, more publicity to cultural heritage, so a lot of benefits, cultural and I would say economic touristic benefits for of the different spin-off effects produced by the valorization of these websites. But then nowadays there is this the problem is that we need to face we have to pay attention because it's true. One side, there is this celebration, this enlightenment of the uniqueness of the cultural heritage. But at the other side, we have also a lot of disadvantages. For example, I mean, UNESCO sites could be the target of the different terrorist attack. Then there is over-exploitation.
Right.
A lot of sites are just destroyed. So, I mean, what should be a positive, I mean, a label that should enhance a positive, a virtuous cycle, it getting the opposite effect. So that's why in the reality, we have also to ask ourselves, does it still make sense to have a UNESCO list?
I think this is quite a provocative question, one that we should be asking is, as this list gets bigger and bigger, is it still necessary or has it played its role? And I wanted to ask Marilena to describe perhaps some case studies for us to kind of consider how does this work? And going back to this idea of the disadvantages and advantages, perhaps even for a local economy, how might we see here in Salzburg, there's an obvious economic advantage to being on the UNESCO World Heritage List. Does it always work that way?
Last year, I did a study on Curaçao. Because it has been inscribed on the UNESCO list. It's one because the Netherlands have just 9 cultural natural sites on the UNESCO list. Uh-huh. And what happens? It's perfect in terms of tourism. The Curaçao city area could see an increase in terms of tourism. But then even if it was already a nice touristic destination because of the sea, the beach, and so on. But then the main issue was that they were not able to combine to develop a synergetic discourse speech approach between the status of UNESCO and the local community. Because if you go there, you can really see that the city is split in 2 different parts. There is one active part, let's say the more touristic one, and then there is the other one. So 2 different colors of the same reality. So it's great to have to have Curaçao on the list, but on the other side, there is no specific or not yet, I mean, I would say yet, specific actions in order to support the local development, the engagement of the local community, because then it seems that it is something that has been imposed, let's say, but is not recognized by the local community.
So perhaps in some of the localities that get designated as World Heritage Sites, the actual local community in the local economy might not mix as well as one thinks. In Curaçao, it seems like we have the tale of 2 different cities. One city, one part of the city at least, is completely separated from the historical center that's being recognized. Now, this raises some other questions when we're talking about the geographies here of UNESCO World Heritage Sites. And I think one of the questions that we really have to look at too, and this is part of, I believe, the move to recognize other forms of heritage, in this case, the intangible, which we are slowly getting to through the episode here. But the recognition of heritage sites around the world and the distribution of those heritage sites has been not as inclusive, let's say, as one might think.
And as we can see in the statistics of UNESCO, there is an unbalanced allocation of sites between East and Western countries. And this unbalance now is let's say, less unbalanced compared to the previous year, because the UNESCO is trying to take in care of a different notion of culture and cultural heritage. Because what happens is that the UNESCO list has been created on the basis of some specific criteria, and these criteria are referring to a notion of culture that is really tangible, really strongly tangible. The problem is that other countries, for example, Africa or Asia, do not share the same concept, of tangible culture as we have in Europe. That means that in Europe we are used to preserve, to conserve the stones, while in Asia or in Africa, the culture is based on the orality. I mean, the most important thing is intangible culture, and that's, of course, if you try to inscribe the cultural or natural sites from Asia, from Africa, it's really difficult to list them to include them in this list, because they don't fill in the requirements of this tangible culture notion. But now there is a sort of a shift, because even in Europe, we are obliged to face with the concept of intangible culture. That means that we recognize the existence not just of the tangible heritage, but there is really this clear movement from the tangible to the intangible dimension.
You are listening to Geographical Imaginations, brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show, check us out online at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Now let's get back to our episode. So next, I want to take us out to the Hallstatt-Dachstein-Salzkammergut cultural landscape. Not to confuse our buildup here to the from the tangible to the intangible, but yet actually I see it as this interesting bridge. The landscape itself is quite beautiful, and I mentioned before, if you watch the opening scenes to The Sound of Music, when there's a aerial photo shots from an airplane or helicopter, you get into this region and you'll really appreciate, I think, being in this alpine landscape. So first, let me describe the official description from the website. The Hallstatt-Dachstein alpine landscape, part of the Salzkammergut, and thus of the Eastern Alps, is one of visual drama, with huge mountains rising abruptly from narrow valleys. Its prosperity since medieval times has been based on salt mining, focused on the town of Hallstatt, a name meaning salt settlement that testifies to its primary function. Systematic salt production was being carried out in the region as early as the Middle Bronze Age, the late 2nd millennium BC, when natural brine was captured in vessels and evaporated. Underground mining for salt began at the end of the Late Bronze Age and resumed in the 8th century BC, when archaeological evidence shows a flourishing, stratified, and highly organized Iron Age society with wide trade links across Europe and now known as the Hallstatt culture. Salt mining continued in Roman times and was then revived in the 14th century. The large amounts of timber needed for the mines and for evaporating the salt were extracted from the extensive upland forests, which since the 16th century were controlled and managed directly by the Austrian crown. The town of Hallstatt was rebuilt in late Baroque style after a fire in 1750 destroyed the timber buildings. The beauty of the alpine landscape, with its higher pastures used for the summer grazing of sheep and cattle since prehistoric times, is part of the process of transhumance, which still today gives the valley communities rights of access to specific grazing areas, was discovered in the early 19th century by writers such as Adalbert Stifler, novelist, and the dramatic poet Franz Grillparzer, and most of the leading paintings of the Biedermeier school. They were in turn followed by tourists, and this led to the development of hotels and brine baths for visitors. The landscape is exceptional as a complex of great scientific interest and immense natural power that has played a vital role in human history, reflected in the impact of farmer miners over millennia, in the way mining has transformed the interior of the mountain, and through the artists and writers that conveyed its harmony and beauty. And so as you could hear from the description, the sound of music isn't part of the official designation or reason why this cultural landscape, this alpine village with its surrounding lakes and mountains, this isn't the reason why the director of Sound of Music is filming that in his initial scenes. That's not why it's on the list. We have these other very historical reasons, including the mining of salt. But the transition I want to make here is really important, and it's about the village of Hallstatt. So when I went there to check it out and see for myself in some way, why is this cultural landscape part of a heritage site, I was immediately faced with hundreds of tourists from China and busloads of tourists from China. And it's not the first time I've seen that phenomenon, that a lot of people from one particular country or one particular place visit a site. Perhaps it's entered into their geographical imagination, images circulating about this place, passed on by word of mouth, and you get this chain effect. We talk about chain migration. Here's sort of chain tourism. And so you get every year an increased, it's almost exponential. You get an increase in the number of tourists. And so I watched this and then looked it up after online and found that in China, currently, and this is through some other media that are reporting on it, there are currently at least 11 towns that are copies of and replicas, I guess you can say, of towns around the world. So there's a Florentia village, which it resembles an Italian village. There's a small version of Paris, even with an Eiffel Tower replica, 354 feet tall. There's the Swiss village of Interlaken. There's which is in a bar district in Beijing. There's a smaller version of Manhattan that was in $50 billion were invested into this. A fishing village was destroyed to make this. There's Thames Town, which is English style, a modern German town, something called Holland Town, a Swedish town. These are it's not quite Epcot, or this is a small world after all, and it's not quite Las Vegas in the sense of these buildings all along the main drags. And it's not just taking a name like we have done plenty of times in the United States. We have Rome, New York. We have Paris, Texas. We have Damascus, Virginia, New London, New York, New Jersey, New Hampshire. It's more than just a place name. This is actually building the town. And Hallstatt is actually one of them. And it cost $940 million to copy the whole town and village in its entirety, down to the details of every building. And this, to me, is fascinating, to the idea that you can copy. And it's a mix of new urbanism, right? This new urbanism that we've seen in films like The Truman Show, the town that's in the panhandle of Florida, Destin, Florida, I believe it's called. But it's this idea that you can copy a town that's stuck with me. And Hallstatt, being part of this UNESCO World Heritage, is quite interesting too. But Hallstatt, for the Chinese, is it copyable? And it raises the question to me, can you really copy a town? What about the spirit of that place? And what about the space, in the sense that a space is alive and dynamic and full of cultural practices and full of history? And so you can't really copy that. You are listening to Geographical Imaginations, brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show, check us out online at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Now let's get back to our episode. So with that, let's hop on the train and head to Vienna and look at this idea of the spirit of the place, because after all, this is what's being recognized by the Austrian government on their list of now intangible heritage. They want to recognize, they want UNESCO eventually to recognize the Viennese coffee house environment or culture. And so we want to unpack this a little bit and look, it's not just the architecture of the coffee house or the coffee itself for that matter, but it's the ambiance, it's the environment, and it's the spirit of the place. The social practices, the rituals, the elegance create the very specific atmosphere of the Viennese cafe. Coffee houses entice with a wide variety of coffee drinks, international newspapers, and pastry creations. Typical for Viennese coffee houses are marble tabletops, toned chairs, newspaper tables, and interior design details in the style of historicism. The Austrian writer Stefan Zweig described the Viennese coffee house as an institution of a special kind, and I quote, "actually a sort of democratic club open to everyone for the price of a cheap cup of coffee, where every guest can sit for hours with this little offering to talk, write, play cards, receive post, and above all, consume an unlimited number of newspapers and journals." Zweig, in fact, attributed a good measure of Viennese cosmopolitan air to the rich daily diet of current and international information offered in the coffee houses. In many classic cafes, for example, Café Central and Café Prückel, piano music is played in the evening and social events like literary readings are held. In warmer months, customers can often sit outside. Almost all coffee houses provide small food dishes like sausages, as well as desserts, cakes, and tarts, like the apple strudel. And like some other cafe traditions around the world, it is completely normal for a customer to linger alone for hours and study the omnipresent newspaper. Along with coffee, the waiter will serve an obligatory glass of cold tap water, and during a long stay will often bring additional water unrequested, with the idea to serve the guest with an exemplary sense of attention. In the late 19th and early 20th century, leading writers of the time became attached to the atmosphere of Viennese cafes and were frequently seen to meet, exchange, and to even write there. Literature composed in cafes is commonly referred to as coffeehouse literature, the writers thereof as coffeehouse poets. The famous journal Die Fackel by Karl Kraus is said to have been written in cafes to a large extent. Other coffeehouse poets include Arthur Schnitzler, Alfred Polgar, Friedrich Thorberg, and Egon Erwin Kisch. Famous writer and poet Peter Altenburg even had his mail delivered to him in his favorite cafe, the Café Central. So let's first, I guess, look at, well, how and why did intangible culture come onto UNESCO's radar?
What precipitates these kinds of actions and policies is the sense of endangerment. So yeah. Endangered species, endangered landscapes, endangered monuments, and the sense of endangerment, which is to say that something is about to disappear, to deteriorate, to be destroyed, that sense was extended beyond the physical environment, that is to say the physical cultural environment, beyond the tangible, beyond the natural environments, whether it was species, landscapes, plants, whatever it might be, and it was extended to these cultural practices. The sense that there were communities that whose cultural practices were very unique, very special, and for a whole range of reasons, were not able to continue doing them, or were about to stop. whether it was an issue of generational transmission or it was that the materials, that the natural materials they needed were no longer available, or it was that there was no audience, or it was that it was not economically viable, or
right.
because there was war. Any one of any number of circumstances that, quote, endangered a set of cultural practices that somehow or other had captured attention and where there was a sense that something of tremendous value was about to disappear. And that precipitates these actions of documentation, preservation, but not, I mean, the thing is the preservation model is very much a tangible heritage model, which is to stop the deterioration of the material.
Yeah.
But a preservation model isn't really great for intangible heritage, because intangible heritage, the real goal of the actions that are taken are the gold standard for it. Let me put it this way. The holy grail of the Intangible Heritage Initiative is to keep that practice going, not to document, preserve it, put it in an archive or a museum,
right.
but to actually create the condition, or at least support the conditions, even if those conditions are new conditions, in fact, to create or to support or to somehow or other, I would say, provide conditions that will allow for the life of that set of cultural practices and the transmission of them. That might mean creating new audiences. It might mean new forms of transmission. It might mean a whole new concept of who can inherit the practice. But it really requires a very different way of thinking.
You're listening to Geographical Imaginations, brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. To find out more about the show, check us out online at www.geographicalimaginations.org. To give some feedback or suggestion for a future episode, go to the comments section on the website, or go to the blog and enter into the conversation. So we find ourselves now inside the cafe scene in Vienna, and we want to return to Marilena to ask a little bit about this idea of why should the Viennese coffee house be on the list of intangible heritage?
Yeah, I think that definitely it should be listened as part of the intangible cultural heritage, because you were right when you pointed out that we have a geographical asset, that means the coffee house, but it's not just this, that means it's the atmosphere, it's the expertise, it's the history, and there are the feeling that are linked, they are supported by this specific place. That means that we can take a coffee house in Vienna and then move it to New York, but then we will not have the same atmosphere, the
right.
same culture,
right.
because it's really, I mean, a combination of different ingredients that are combined in order to get this specific culture that we have. So it's not just a question to take the tangible element and to move it to a different place and we can duplicate.
Now, you mentioned this concept of the genius loci,
yeah.
or spirit of place. Is that kind of, I think, is that what's being, I don't know, are we conserving it? I guess that enters into another question. Are we trying to conserve through the intangible cultural inventory? Are we trying to conserve it, the spirit of this place? Is that
Because this is really, because it's a force, it's essential, because I mean, It's essential, I would say, because of its specific nature. Because we cannot, we don't have, we, of course, we can have some tangible elements, but it's really the expertise, it's the culture, and culture for its nature is intangible, even if it can be substantiated and developed, expressed with some more tangible things, I would say. But then the idea is really to keep and going on this concept, this culture, from one generation to another one. And then again, it's a question of spirit, of intangible dimension of culture, but at the same time, it's also a question to make this concept resilient, make this concept sustainable, and give the opportunity to the future generation to enjoy this concept, this culture, this genius loci. Because when we are taking decision within cultural heritage, I mean, in terms of conserving, preserving cultural heritage, we have to figure, to use, to adopt a sort of a cooperative approach. That means that we don't have to take decisions just based on our own interests, but we have to think about the potential and the future generation consumers, because they are not born yet, but they have the right to enjoy what we have enjoyed. So the idea is really to install, to develop a sort of virtuous cycle in order to give, to provide, to diffuse and to protect and transmit this intangible cultural heritage, the spirit of the place, as you mentioned. It's really the most, it's really relevant, because we need people, we need memory. And this is essential in order to install this positive, virtuous cycle, I would say.
Is there a risk of trying to conserve what one group of people think is the authentic Viennese coffee house, and so they're trying to that could be fueled by nostalgia, but it also could be sort of this golden era, and this is just to be a little critical, the golden era of literature in Vienna, when the coffee house was that hub. Is it still that place? Does it still have that vibrancy? Or is it trying to sort of museumify that?
Yeah, then I would say that the main issues that we have to cope within cultural heritage is the commodification. That means right. that we don't want commodification, right? Mm-hmm. The idea is that cultural heritage should still be active, dynamic.
You are listening to Geographical Imaginations, brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show, check us out online at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Now let's get back to our episode. So in our final comment tonight from Dr. Kirschenblatt-Gimblett, I think it's really important for us to kind of consider, and she really hits it home in terms of when we just remember the tangible, and this kind of brings us back, I think, and covers a lot of what we've talked about tonight. If we're just to remember the tangible, we're missing, I think, the moment, the event, the energy, in terms of the geographical imagination here, we're missing the dynamics of the space, the mechanics of the space, the cultural practices of a space that, well, you just can't put into a box or a case or carve in place on a pedestal. These are fluid practices. These are energies. These are creative. These are in the moment. These are things that are passed down. It's knowledge that's passed from one person to another. But she uses the example here of Venice. And if we're to go to Carnival,
who would study a ritual and only collect the masks and not study them in relationship to how they're used and in relation to Carnival? Can you imagine Carnival as a collection of costumes? That's what, if you were to reduce Carnival to material heritage, to tangible heritage, if you were to reduce Carnival to tangible heritage, you would have a collection of costumes and steel drums.
Right. And it's not, and then it avoids looking at sort of the reproduction year in and year out of the sort of vibrancy of that space and what's happening.
It's an event.
Yeah.
The carnival's an event. And
yeah.
The idea of making that kind of distinction between the tangible part of the event and the intangible part of the event is completely artificial.
So I think in tonight's exploration, we start with Salzburg and think about the commodification of its historical downtown, its UNESCO World Heritage Site, essentially, and really want to ask ourselves the question about, I think, what is being celebrated, and is it a spirit of the history and the, of the past? Is it trying to reach some sort of level of authenticity? The same we could ask about Hallstatt and trying to replicate that landscape, well, in this case, the cityscape or villagescape, somewhere else. Can you export it? Just like we asked and raised the question about the Viennese coffee house, can you actually open one in New York and think of it as a authentic and typical Viennese coffee house? The same could be said about a beer garden, maybe in Cincinnati, Ohio. Can that be the same as one in the kind of feeling that you get at being one here in Salzburg or Munich, for that matter? So these are the kinds of questions I think we want to ask. Is this intangible culture, in the case of what we're talking about here, this genius loci, or spirit of place, can that actually be replicated? And I think in our exploration tonight, we may have come to some conclusions. So I'll leave you tonight and wish you the best, and look forward to talking to you in 1 month's time. But I'll leave you tonight with a scene from Café Havalka, one of the major more well-known Vienna coffee houses in the Austrian capital.
I'm going to go to the next one.